comprehended the power he held. Uxtal could barely master his own terror in the Gola's presence. Though only a child, Vladimir was nearly the same size as the diminutive Tliloxu. Unexpectedly, though, Uxtal had managed to endear himself to the Gola in a way that had the benefit of driving a wedge between the boy and Helica. As a Tliloxu, he had many personal habits that outsiders considered revolting, such as his proclivity to emit coarse bodily noises. Seeing the Baron's delight in such grossness, Uxtal began to embellish his own habits around the child, which gave the two of them a peculiar bond. Miffed at Vladimir's fickle attentions and showing no more maturity than the child Gola, Helica had stopped associating with the boy. She reacted with haughty indifference when the guild ship came to take Uxtal and the Gola away to Dan. But the anxious researcher knew she would be there waiting when he returned. After a fold space journey, the Tliloxu and his charge rode a shuttle down to the watery planet. En route, they played a private game, competing with one another to see who could be the most disgusting, to see if they could get a reaction out of the bland and stony face dancers accompanying them. Vladimir, with an amazing repertoire of scatological talents, made more revolting sounds and noxious odors than anyone Uxtal had ever encountered. After each display, the cherubic boy grinned fiercely. Uxtal conceded defeat, knowing it was safer to lose to a Harkonnen than to win, even without Matre Superior Helica leering over their shoulders. One of the face dancers stood at the shuttle's viewport, pointing outside. The ruins of Castle Caladan, the ancestral home of House Atreides. The edifice lay in broken fragments of stone at the edge of a seaside cliff, with a landing field not far away on the outskirts of a nearby fishing village. The face dancer obviously intended to bring Vladimir to a place that might evoke a visceral reaction, but Uxtal detected no glimmer of recognition in the boy's spider-black eyes, no spark of recollection. The Baron Gola was far too young to access his memories yet, but by placing him in the environment of his arch-enemies, with so many potential memory triggers, maybe they would awaken something after all, or at least lay a good foundation for success. Perhaps that was what Krone wanted of them. Uxtal hoped so, wishing he could stay here on Dan permanently. Though somewhat austere and damp, the ocean world seemed a great improvement over Bandalong. As soon as they stepped off the shuttle onto the paved field, Vladimir stared toward the ruined castle. His shaggy hair blew in a sea breeze. My enemies lived here? This is where Duke Leto Atreides was from? Though Uxtal didn't know the answer for certain, he knew what the Gola boy wanted to hear. Yes. He must have been where you are standing, breathing the same air that fills your lungs now. Why can't I remember? I want to remember. I want to know more than you told me, more than I can see in film books. He stamped a foot on the ground. And one day you will. One day it will all come back to you. I want it now. The child looked up with a peevish expression, puckering his lips. This, Uxtal knew, signified dangerous potential. He took the boy's hand and led him quickly toward a waiting ground car before the childish temper could explode. Come, let's see what the face dancers have found. Knowing the decisions and the mistakes made by others can be frightening. More often, though, I find it comforting. Reverend Mother Shiana, Ithaca Logs. The Van Gogh painting hung on a metal wall of Shiana's cabin. She had stolen the masterpiece from the Mother Superior's quarters before escaping from Chapter House. Of all the crimes she had committed during her flight, taking the Van Gogh was her only selfish and unjustified act. For years, she had drawn comfort from this great work of art and everything it represented. With the glow panels adjusted to perfect illumination, Shiana stood unblinking before the masterpiece. Though she had studied the painting meticulously many times, she still gained new insight from the daubs of bright paint, the thick brush strokes, the chaotic flurry of creative energy. A deeply disturbed man, Van Gogh had turned these splotches and smudges of color into a work of genius. Could pure, cold sanity have done as much? Cottages at Corderville had survived the atomic destruction of Earth ages ago, the Butlerian Jihad and ensuing Dark Ages, then Muad'Dib's Jihad, 3,500 years of the tyrant's rule, the famine times, and the scattering. Without doubt, this fragile piece of art was blessed. But its creator had been driven to the brink of madness by his passions. Van Gogh had channeled his vision into color and form, a representational splash of reality so intense that it could only be conveyed on canvas. One day, she would show the painting to the Gola children. Paul Atreides, the oldest, was now 5 years old and showed every sign of being just a normal little boy. His mother, Jessica, was a year younger, the same age as the Gola of the warrior Mentat Thufir Hawat. Paul's love, Cheney, was only 3, while the historic traitor to House Atreides, Wellington Yui, was 2, born at the same time that Shiana had finally allowed Cytale to create a Gola of himself. The great planetologist and Fremen leader Liet Kynes was a year-old baby, and the naive Stilgar had just been born. It would be years before the Bene Gesserit had any chance of triggering those Gola memories, before the historical recreations could become the weapons and tools Shiana needed. If she showed them the Van Gogh painting right now, would they react based on some instinct from their past lives? Or would they view the images with fresh eyes? A genius from Ix had restored and enhanced the original. An invisibly thin but tough coating of plaz sealed and protected the masterwork from further aging. The Ixian restorer had not only returned the painting to its original glory, he had added interactive simulations so that an appreciative observer could go through the process of every brushstroke, seeing the complex and primitive marvel as it had been created from layer upon layer of paint. Shiana had experienced the instructional simulation enough times that she felt she could have repainted the cottages herself with her eyes closed. But even if she'd made a perfect copy, it wouldn't have been the same as the original. Shiana backed up to her bed and sat down, never taking her eyes from the painting. The voices in other memory seemed to appreciate it, though she kept the constant clamor under control. Odraid within spoke to her now in a scolding tone. I am sure other sisters consider the theft of Vincent's painting to be more serious than stealing the no-ship or sandworms from the desert belt. Those things could be replaced, but not a masterpiece. Maybe I am not the person you thought I was. But then I, more than anyone else, can't live up to the myth built around me. Does the cult of Shiana still have followers out there in the old empire? Does your manufactured religion still revere me as an angel and a savior? The Bene Gesserit knew the powers of unflagging belief among vast populations. The sisters harnessed religions as weapons, created them, guided them, and turned them loose as one might aim an arrow from a bow. Religions were odd things. They were born with the emergence of a strong and charismatic leader, yet somehow they grew more powerful after that keystone figure died, especially if martyred. No army ever fought harder without its bashar. No government grew stronger without its king or president. Yet a religion without Shiana spread faster once the converts believed she was dead. Shiana's unique background had given the Missionaria Protectiva plenty to work with, enough raw material to attract fanatics in droves. Here, in her quiet, peaceful quarters, she was glad to be far from all that. At the thought of being a supposed martyr around whom a powerful religion had grown, she felt another life awaken and rise up within her, a distant, ancient voice. Both Muad'Dib and Liet Kynes spoke against the dangers of following a charismatic hero. When the lives within permitted it, she liked to delve deeply into lines of other memory, looking farther and farther back in time, into the backwash and whitewater rapids of the river of history. I agree. That is why those who would throw away their lives in such a cause must be watched and guided. Guided? Or manipulated? The difference is only a matter of words, not substance. There are times when manipulating the masses is the only way to form an adequate defense. A fighting force of fanatics can surpass any number of enemy weapons. Paul Muad'Dib proved that. His bloody jihad rocked the galaxy. The other voice chuckled within her. He was by no means the first to use such tactics. He learned much from the past. He learned much from me. Shiana cast her inner vision deep into her mind. Who are you? I am one who knows this subject better than most. Better than almost anyone. The voice paused. I am Serena Butler. I started the mother of all jihads. With Serena Butler's warning fresh in her mind, Shiana strode through a lower-level corridor. Considering all the factions aboard the Ithaca, each with their own agendas and distortions, Shiana knew of an innocent yet impenetrable source of information. The four captive Futars. The creatures had caused no further trouble in the 5 years since one had escaped from the brig and killed a sister, a minor proctor. Shiana had visited them on occasion and talked to all of them, but so far she had been frustrated in her attempts to gain useful information. Nevertheless, Serena Butler had given her a new idea, to use religious awe as a tool. Confident that she could protect herself if necessary, she released the one that called himself Herm from the large holding chamber where the Futars now lived. Years ago, after she had found Herm loose in the lower corridors, she had done everything possible to give him and his companions a larger space. They were predators, feral things, and they needed to run and roam. So, Shiana had added security systems to an armor-walled storage bay, then instructed several proctors and a few of the rabbi's hard-working Jews to construct a simulated environment. The new enclosure did not fool the Futars, but it comforted them. Though not quite freedom, it was far preferable to the stark, separated brig cells. During the construction of the special arboretum, Shiana had done her best to find out what their original home with the handlers had been like, but the Futars offered few details. Their vocabulary was quite limited. When they said trees, she could not get them to describe the size or species. Instead, she resorted to showing them images until they finally grew excited, pointing to a tall, silver-barked aspen. Now, after ensuring that the nearby corridors and lift tubes were empty of distractions or threats, Shiana took the tense beast man to the observation chamber above the sand-filled hold. Herm paced warily along beside her. The honored Matres had abused him so terribly that he was reluctant to extend trust. But in the years since Shiana had begun visiting the Futars, Herm had come to accept her. She often talked with the creatures inside their holding chamber, trying to coax information from them. The Futars were too simple and direct to keep secrets, but they plainly did not comprehend the implications of the things they understood. In order to draw information out of them, Shiana decided she needed to make a stronger impression. Although it went against her usual principles, she decided to portray herself as the Missionaria Protectiva did, as a religious figure who wielded mystical powers. The Futars would see her in a different light. Perhaps if she could impress Herm, he would answer the same questions, but in a more useful manner. Inside the observation chamber, the Futar stepped closer to the plaz window and looked down toward the sand inside the cargo hold. His pupils dilated and his nostrils flared when he saw movement there, the stirring dunes. One of the large sandworms rose up, its cavernous mouth yawning open as sand streamed from its rings. The blind head of a second worm rose, as if the creatures could sense Shiana's presence high above them. Herm backed away, his lips curling in a half-snarl. His breathing sounded like a growl. Monsters. Yes, my monsters. The Futar seemed confused and intimidated. Herm could not take his eyes from the worms. My monsters, she repeated. You stay here and watch. Shiana slipped away from the chamber and code-locked the door behind her before taking a lift directly down to the cargo hold level. She opened the hatch and stepped out onto the temperature-controlled sands under artificial yellow sunlight. The sandworms came toward her, shaking the hold with their weight and friction. Unafraid, Shiana marched out and climbed up the dunes to face them. With a burst of sand, the largest worm rose up, followed by a second one beside it and a third behind her. Shiana stared up toward the small, dark observation window through which she hoped Herm was watching her with awe. She ran toward the nearest worm, and the giant backed away, scuttling through the sand. She ran at another, and it also retreated. Then she stood in the middle and began to twirl. She waved her hands at the worms and began swaying back and forth in a lissom dance. The worms followed, also weaving, swaying. Around her, she could smell fresh spice, the bitter yet stimulating aroma that had no other natural origin. The worms circled her like sycophants. Finally, Shiana collapsed onto the sand and let them continue their circling until all seven of the worms reared up around her and she dismissed them. Turning tail, the creatures rippled through the contained dunes, leaving her. Shiana struggled to her feet, brushed herself off, and went to the hatch. By now, Herm should be sufficiently impressed. When she re-entered the observation chamber, the Futar turned to her, then backed away and raised his face, baring his own throat in a gesture of submission. Shiana felt the warmth of the moment thrill through her. My monsters, she said. You stronger than bad women, Herm said. Yes, stronger than honored Matres. The beast man seemed to force the words from his throat. Better than handlers. Shiana pounced. Who are the handlers? Handlers. Where are they? Who are they? Handlers control Futars. What are Futars? She needed to know more, needed to pin him down. There were too many questions about what the Horrors had brought from the scattering and how they were all connected to the outside enemy. We are Futars, Herm said, sounding indignant. Not fish people. Ah, an intriguing new nugget of information. Fish people? Phibians. Herm growled with disgust. His mouth had trouble forming the word. Shiana frowned, imagining a modification that combined amphibious genes with humans, the same way feline DNA had been used to create Futars. Hybrids. Did the Handlers create Phibians? Handlers made Futars. We are Futars. Did they also create Phibians? Herm seemed to grow angry. Handlers made Futars. Kill honored Matres. Shiana fell silent, processing the information. The method of chromosomal tinkering that had created Futars might be similar to what was used to breed aquatic-dwelling Phibians. While the Handlers had used those techniques to breed creatures who would target honored Matres, someone else had made Phibians. To what purpose? She wondered if lost Tliloxu from the scattering had sold their skills to the highest bidder. If the Futars hated Phibians, then were the fish people somehow allied with the honored Matres? Or was Shiana simply reading too much into the crude utterances of the Beastman? Who are the Handlers? She said again. You better, Herm answered. It was all the response she could get. Though he looked at her in a different way, Shiana had achieved no insights or vital information. Just clues, without the necessary context. She took him back to his holding cell and turned him loose among the other Futars. She didn't know how well they communicated with one another, but she was certain Herm would share what he had learned. He would tell his fellows about the woman who controlled the worms. The best method of attack is to make a quick kill. Always be ready to strike your opponent's jugular. If you want to provide a performance, be a dancer. Mother Commander Mirbella, rally before troop deployment. When the enemy came, the new sisterhood would not fight every battle alone. Mirbella refused to allow that. Though there was no central leadership in the disjointed civilizations of the old empire, she vowed that she would compel those civilizations to participate. They could not be allowed to sit on the sidelines when so much was at stake for humanity. Under the instruction of her daughter Jeunesse, as well as the veteran Bashar Wiki Azdin, the Sisterhood's deadliest fighters were being trained, but Mirbella needed access to powerful weapons, and a great many of them. Therefore, she went to Richesi, the primary competitor of Ix. After Mirbella's small shuttle landed in the main Richesian commercial complex, the factory commissioner arrived to meet her. He was a short man with a round face, close-cropped hair, and a sincere-looking smile that he could mount on his face at will. Two women and three men accompanied him, all wearing identical, smart-looking business attire. They carried projection pads and easily revised papers, contracts, price lists. The new sisterhood wishes to do business with you, Commissioner. Please show me everything you have in the way of weaponry, offensive and defensive. Beaming, the round-faced man reached forward to clasp her hand, which she reluctantly allowed him to shake. Richesi is glad to be of service, Mother Commander. We can manufacture anything from a dagger to a fleet of battleships. Are you interested in explosives, hand weapons, projectile launchers? We have defensive space mines that can be hidden by no fields. Please tell me, what is your particular need? Mirbella met him with a hard gaze. Everything. We're going to need the whole list. For thousands of years, Richesi and Ix had been technological and industrial rivals, each with their own areas of expertise. Ix had made its name doing groundbreaking research, producing creative designs, and pioneering new technologies. Though many of their projects failed spectacularly, the successful ones generated sufficient profits to more than pay for the mistakes. Richesi, on the other hand, was better at imitation than innovation. They were more conservative in the risks they took, yet increasingly ambitious in their output and efficiency. By taking advantage of economies of scale, cutting profit margins, and pushing automated factory lines to the very limits of what the strictures of the Butlerian Jihad allowed, Richesi was able to produce sought-after items in huge quantities at low cost. Mirbella selected them over Ix because the new sisterhood needed huge numbers of weapons as soon as possible. The business complex where the factory commissioner always met his potential customers included lush landscaping with parks and fountains. The buildings were clean, stylized, and welcoming. Any unsightly industrial zones remained far from view. Walking down spacious hallways lined with showcases of items that Richesi could produce on a moment's notice, Mirbella felt as if she were wandering through an unending exhibit hall of marketing displays. Giving her plenty of time to examine the merchandise, the commissioner chattered as they walked from one display case to another. Since the death of the tyrant and the famine times, Richesi has been called on to provide defensive armaments for any number of brush fire wars. You will be satisfied with what we can produce. If we survive the coming conflict, then I will be satisfied. She studied body armor and ship armor, pseudo-atomics, laser guns, projectile launchers, micro-explosives, pulse cannons, blasters, poison dusts, shard daggers, flechette guns, disruptors, mine scramblers, offensive X-probes, hunter-seeker assassination tools, deceptives, energizers, burners, dart launchers, stun grenades, even genuine atomics for display purposes only. A holo model of Richesi's southern continents showed vast shipyards producing space yachts and military no-ships. Mirbella said, "I want all of those space yachts converted into warships. In fact, we need to commandeer all of your factory systems. You must completely devote your production lines to producing the weapons we need." The attorneys and salespeople gasped, then consulted with each other. The factory commissioner seemed alarmed. "That is quite an astonishing request, Mother Commander. We do have other customers, you know." "None more important than we are." She fixed him with a cold glare. "We will pay for the privilege, of course, in melange." The commissioner's eyes lit up. "It has long been said that wartime is hard on people, but good for business. Doesn't the guild have a standing order for all the spice your new desert belt produces?" "I have severely restricted guild purchases, though their demand remains high," Mirbella said. The Richesian was already aware of this, of course. He was simply playing a game. The hovering attorneys and sales representatives were mentally going through some preliminary calculations. After they were paid in melange, the Richesians could turn around and sell the spice to the desperate guild for 10 times the already steep value the new sisterhood had placed on it. They would reap profits backward and forward. Mirbella crossed her arms over her chest. "We will need a military force such as humanity has never before seen, because we face an enemy unlike any other." "I've heard rumors." Who is this foe, and when will they strike? What do they want? She blinked as a flicker of anxiety passed through her. I wish I knew. First, though, her fighting squads would face the rebel-honored Matres in their dispersed enclaves, and for that she needed armored thopters, assault ships, heavy ground cars, personal projectile launchers, pulse rifles, and even razor-sharp monoblade knives. Many of the battles against the dissidents would involve close-in fighting. We can provide certain items immediately from our stockpiles. A few ships, some space mines. One warlord customer recently suffered from, an assassination. Therefore, his completed order remains unclaimed, and we can offer you all of it. I'll take it with me now, she said. The mother commander continued to train her troops, honing them into a razor-sharp weapon. Wearing a black single-suit uniform, Mirbella stood beside Jeunesse on a suspensor platform that floated low over the largest training field. Below, in midday sunlight, her hand-picked troops went through increasingly difficult personal combat routines, never resting, never tolerating the smallest mistake. Upon hearing that Mirbella's special squad had crushed the encampment of dissidents on Chapter House, her advisors had been shocked at the swift brutality, but the mother commander stood firm against the uproar. I am not Bashar Miles Teg. He could have used his reputation to subtly manipulate the malcontents and might have reached a compromise that skated past violence. But the Bashar is no longer with us, and I fear his clever tactics will not be effective against the Armageddon forces of the enemy. Violence will become more and more necessary. The women had found no effective counter-argument. After that first decisive battle, the Mother Commander's crack forces took a new name for themselves, Valkyries. Mirbella challenged her Valkyries to master a type of fighting that Jeunesse had rediscovered in the archives, the techniques of the Swordmasters of Ganaz. By resurrecting that training discipline and arming her sisters with skills that no one alive remembered, the Mother Commander intended to produce fighters better equipped than any before them to neutralize the entrenched honored Matres. At the moment, the squads were executing a complex maneuver in which they fought against mock enemy troops on the ground, attacking them in spinning star formations. Viewed from the high suspensor platform, the show was quite impressive as the 5 points of each star rotated and surged against the opposing force and sent them fleeing in disarray. It was something Mirbella called the choreography of personal combat. She could not wait to test it in battle. Like her mother, Jeunesse plunged into her work with fervor. She had even adopted the surname of her father, calling herself Lieutenant Idaho. It sounded right to her and to Mirbella. Mother and daughter were becoming quite a formidable force. Some sisters jokingly claimed that they didn't need an army. Those two were dangerous enough on their own. Wearing a satisfied look, the mother commander reviewed the troop formations. Jeunesse, too, was clearly proud of the trained fighters. I will pit our Valkyries against any army the honored Matres can raise against us. Yes, Jeunesse, you will. And soon. First, we will conquer Boozle. Muad'Dib could indeed see the future, but you must understand the limits of this power. Think of sight. You have eyes, yet cannot see without light. If you were on the floor of a valley, you cannot see beyond your valley. Just so, Muad'Dib could not always choose to look across the mysterious terrain. He tells us that a single obscure decision of prophecy, perhaps the choice of one word over another, could change the entire aspect of the future. He tells us the vision of time is broad, but when you pass through it, time becomes a narrow door. and always. He fought the temptation to choose a clear, safe course, warning, that path leads ever down into stagnation. From Arrakis Awakening by the Princess Irulan. The planet Dan was full of face dancers. Just by looking at the natives in the settlement near the ruined Atreides castle, Uxtal could sense them everywhere. His skin crawled, but he didn't dare show fear. Maybe he could slip away, run to hide in the wilderness of the headlands, or pretend to be a simple fisherman or cliff farmer. But if he tried any of that, the face dancers would hunt him down and capture him, punish him. He didn't dare risk their wrath, so he meekly followed along. Maybe Crone would be so pleased to see the barren child that he would simply free Uxtal, reward him for his service, and send him away. The lost Tleilaxu researcher could cling to unrealistic hopes. He and young Vladimir were taken to temporary quarters in a hostelry on the outskirts of the village. The boy Gola complained that he wanted to throw rocks in the water and at the boats, or poke into the market stalls where sellers gutted the fish, but Uxtal made excuses, delaying the restless child while they waited in their rustic, chilly room. Vladimir began to ransack every cabinet and hiding place he could find. Uxtal clung to the knowledge that at least the honored Matres were far away. A nondescript man appeared at the door of their room. He looked like any other villager, but a rash of goosebumps stippled Uxtal's skin. I have come to take the Baron Gola. We must test him. He heard an odd sound, as of bones cracking and shifting. The man's face metamorphosed until the blank, cadaverous face of Crone stared back at him with ink-pit eyes.
Yes, Uxtal said. The boy is progressing quite nicely. 7 years old now. However, it would be very helpful to me if I knew what you want him for. Very helpful.
Vladimir watched the face dancer with curious awe. He had never seen one of the shapeshifters revert to its blank state.
Great trick. Can you teach me to change my face like that?
No. Crone turned back to the Tleilaxu. When I originally asked you to grow this Gola, I did not know who he was. When I learned his identity, I still did not know if the Baron Harkonnen would do us any good, but I thought that he might. Now, I have discovered a wonderful possibility. He took the boy's hand and led him away. Wait here, Uxtal. So the diminutive researcher remained alone in his primitive room, wondering how much longer he would be permitted to live. In another situation, he might have enjoyed the moment of peace, the quiet relaxation, but he was too afraid. What if the face dancers found some flaw in the Gola? Why did they need him here on Dan? Would Crone throw him back into the clutches of Matre Superior Helica? The face dancers had left him among the honored Matres for years. Uxtal didn't know how much more he could stand. He couldn't believe Helica had let him live, or that the withered old Ingva hadn't yet tried to bond him sexually. He closed his eyes and swallowed the moan in his throat. So many things could go wrong if he went back there. To calm himself, he began a traditional cleansing ritual. Standing next to an open window and facing the ocean, he dipped a white cloth into a bowl of water and washed his naked chest. It had been so long since he'd been able to adequately perform the personal body ablutions required by his religion. People were always spying on him, intimidating him. After he finished, Uxtal meditated outside on a small wooden balcony that overlooked the fishing village.
He prayed by mentally rearranging numbers and signs, searching for the truth in the holy patterns. The door of the room burst open, and the Gola child ran in, flushed and laughing. He carried a dripping knife and dodged among the rough furniture as if playing some sort of game. His clothes were covered in wet mud and blood. Crone followed the boy into the room at a more sedate pace, carrying a small parcel in his arms. He had reverted to his innocuous guise of a bland-featured man. Chuckling, young Vladimir called for Crone to hurry. Uxtal quickly intercepted the boy. "What are you doing with that knife?" He extended a hand to take the weapon away.
"I was playing with a baby Slig. They have a little pen of them in the village, but none of them are big like back home."
He grinned.
"I jumped in with them and stabbed a few."
He wiped the blade on his own black trousers and handed it to the Tlilaxu, who set it out of reach atop a tall wardrobe. Crone looked contemplatively at the bloodstains.
"I am not averse to violence, but it must be directed violence.
Constructive violence.
This Gola has little self-control. He is in need of behavioral modifications."
Uxtal tried to deflect the conversation from the implied criticism. "Why did he grab a knife and jump into a Slig pen?"
"He was influenced by our conversation. I was discussing our discovery with my comrades, and the boy drew inspiration from the object. He seems to have a fondness for knives."
"Matre Superior Helica taught him that."
Uxtal swallowed hard.
"I have read his cellular history. The original Baron Harkonnen was..."
"I know everything about the original. He has excellent potential for what I have in mind now. Our plans have changed because of what we've discovered here on Dan."
Uxtal stared at the mysterious parcel in the face dancer's hands.
"And what have you found?"
Though his gash mouth did not smile, Crone seemed very pleased. He began to unwrap the object.
"Another solution to our crisis."
"Which crisis?"
"One you cannot understand."
Feeling chastised, Uxtal bit back further questions and stared as Crone revealed another knife, this one ornate and sealed inside a clear plas container. The weapon had a jeweled handle with intricate designs carved into it. The blade itself bore etched letters and symbols from an ancient language, but the words were obscured by a thick smear of crimson. Blood, barely oxidized. He leaned closer. It still looked moist inside its preservative cover.
"This is an ancient weapon, thousands of years old, sealed inside a null entropy field until today. Hidden and protected over the centuries by a succession of religious fanatics."
"Is that blood?" Uxtal asked.
"I prefer to call it genetic material."
Gingerly, the face dancer set the artifact on the table.
"We discovered it in a long-sealed religious shrine here on Dan, watched over by remnants of the fish speakers who have now joined the cult of Shiana. The dagger is stained with the blood of Paul Atreides."
"Muad'Dib? The father of the prophet himself, Leto II, the god emperor?"
"Yes. The messiah who led Fremen warriors in a great jihad. A Kwisatz Haderach. We need him."
"Because of the null entropy field, the blood of Muad'Dib is still wet."
"Fresh," Uxtal said, quivering in excitement. perfectly preserved. Ah, so you see where this is leading. There is hope for you yet. You may be useful after all.
Yes, I am useful. Let me show you. But I need to know more about what you want.
At a hand gesture from their leader, two more face dancers entered the room, leading a wrung-out woman who wore a deep blue dress. Her brown hair hung in stringy clumps. As she drew near, Uxtal noted the famous Atreides crest of long ago, a red braided hawk on the left breast of her dress. When she saw the preserved dagger, the woman struggled against her captors. She didn't seem to care about the face dancers or anyone, only the knife. Crone prodded her. Speak, priestess. Tell this man the story of your holy knife so that he may understand. She looked at Uxtal briefly, then turned her worshipful gaze back toward the dagger.
I am Ardath, formerly a fish speaker priestess, now servant of Shiana. Long ago, the evil Count Hasmir Fenring attempted to assassinate the blessed Muad'Dib with this dagger. The weapon belonged to Emperor Shaddam IV, was given to Duke Leto Atreides as a gift, and then returned to Shaddam during his trial before the Landsraad. Later, Emperor Shaddam offered the dagger to Faedrautha for his duel with Muad'Dib. Priestess Ardath seemed to be reciting often rehearsed scripture. Later, during Muad'Dib's jihad, an exiled Hasmir Fenring, himself a failed Kwisatz Haderach, acquired the dagger. In a vile plot, he stabbed Muad'Dib deeply in the back. Some say that he died that day from the wound, but that heaven sent him back among the living, for his work was not yet done. In a miracle, he returned to us.
And Muad'Dib's fanatics preserved the bloody knife as a religious artifact. Crone finished impatiently. It was taken to a shrine here on Caladan, home of House Atreides, where it remained hidden for all these years. You can already guess what we want you to do, Tliloxu. Deactivate the null entropy field. Take cell samples.
Ardath tore herself free of her guards and dropped to her knees in prayer, leaning toward the ancient relic.
Please, you cannot tamper with such a holy article.
At a gesture from Crone, one of the face dancers grabbed her head and twisted it sharply, snapping her neck. He dropped her to the floor like a discarded doll. As they dragged the dead priestess away, Uxtal gave the female no more than a passing thought, since she was irrelevant. Instead, he was intrigued by the possibilities of the lovely, preserved dagger. Her prattling had been distracting anyway. He came closer and picked up the sealed dagger with shaking hands, tilting it so that light glistened off the wet blade. The cells of Muad'Dib. The possibilities astounded him. Crone said, Now you have another Gola project to work on, along with raising Baron Harkonnen. Back to Tlilox with you both, for as many years as it takes. More face dancers came into the room. When the time is right, we will have a much more useful purpose for the Baron.
The honored Matre defenses on Buzel are minimal. We can simply stroll in and take over. Another symptom of their arrogance.
Bashar Wiki Asden, military advisor to Mother Commander Mirbella. The first new armored vessels arrived from Richesi exactly as Mirbella had ordered, 67 warships designed for space combat and troop transport, heavily loaded with weaponry. The mother commander had also paid the appropriate bribes in spice for a guild ship to transport them directly and unexpectedly to Boozle. It was the first of what she hoped would be many conquests over the renegade honored Matres. The weapons shops of Richesi, thrilled with the enormous order for armaments, worked overtime to create military equipment of every possible design and efficacy. When the outside threat did arrive in the old empire, they would not find the human race unprepared or undefended. First, however, the restructured sisterhood had to quash the destructive resistance here at home. We must clean the slate before the real enemy arrives. In deep consultation with Belanda, Doria, and Jeunesse, Mirbella had chosen this first campaign carefully. Now that her Valkyries had eradicated the malcontents on Chapter House, the well-trained women were ready for another target. Boozle was perfect, both for its strategic and economic importance. The honored Matres were haughty and overconfident, making their defenses vulnerable. Mirbella intended to show them no mercy. She did not know the precise disposition or distribution of honored Matre defenses around Boozle, but she could guess. Sitting inside their ships within the hold of the great guild ship, all of her Valkyries were ready to be deployed. As soon as the guild ship emerged from fold space, its lower doors yawned open. The women neither asked for nor received further instructions, since they knew what to do. Find priority targets and destroy them. 67 vessels, all equipped with cutting-edge weapons technology, poured out and opened fire with projectiles and targeted explosives that began shredding the 15 large honored Matre frigates stationed in orbit. The honored Matres had no time to react, and barely enough time to bellow their outrage over the comm systems. In 10 minutes, the bombardment turned every single vessel into lifeless, floating scrap metal. Boozle was now undefended.
Mother Commander, 12 unaligned ships are flying away from the atmosphere. A different design. They don't appear to be combat craft.
Smugglers, Mirbella said. Sue stones are valuable, so there will always be smugglers.
Shall we destroy them, Mother Commander, or seize their cargoes?
Neither. She watched the tiny ships flitting away from the ocean world. If the smugglers had proved to be a significant drain on the Sioux Stone wealth, the honored Matres would never have let them survive.
We have a more important target down there.
We'll oust the honored Matres and negotiate with the smugglers afterward. She led the warships to their formal conquest of the few specks of habitable land on the vast, fertile ocean. Boozle had long been used as a Bene Gesserit punishment planet where the Sisterhood discarded those who had disappointed them, women who had failed the ancient order in some manner. The ocean world wasn't much to look at, but the rich, deep sea was home to shelled creatures called collisters, that produced elegant gems.
Sue stones. Noble women flaunted them. Collectors and artisans paid inflated prices for them.
Like Rakis, she thought.
Ironic that the worst places produce the items of greatest value.
The honored Matre's inexorable search for wealth had drawn their attentions to Boozle years ago. After the whores overran the islands on the vast oceans, they killed most of the disgraced Bene Gesserit sisters and forced the survivors to harvest Sioux stones for them. Now, assisted by orbital surveillance, Mirbella easily determined which were the main inhabited land masses barely poking above the waves. The new sisterhood would recapture the nerve centers of Sioux stone activity from the honored Matres. Soon, Boozle would have different leaders. The Richesian battlecraft landed around the primary Soustone processing encampment. Such a great number of vessels overwhelmed the tiny landing area, and most were forced to rely on inflatable pontoons, raft piers, and simple suspensor fields on the water. Ships encircled the rocky island like a noose. As it turned out, apart from the frigates in orbit, barely more than 100 of the Horrors held the facilities of Boozle in their iron grip. When the Valkyries arrived, the honored Matres who lived on this island in the finest, though still Spartan buildings, rushed out, fully armed. Though they fought viciously, the women were greatly outnumbered and outmatched. Mirbella's fighters easily assassinated half of them before the rest capitulated. The losses were expected. The Mother Commander strode out into the biting, salty air to begin surveying the sparse world she had just conquered. When the fighters rounded up the surviving honored Matres, Mirbella discovered 9 women who clearly did not belong among them, downtrodden yet proud in tattered black robes. Bene Gesserit. Only 9. Boozle had been a punishment planet for well over 100 sisters, and only 9 had survived the Horrors. Mirbella stalked back and forth, looking at the gathered women. Her Valkyries stood in formation behind her, their black single-suit uniforms embellished with sharp black spikes, used as ornamentation and weapons. The honored Matres looked defiant, murderous, exactly as Mirbella expected. The captive sisters averted their eyes, having spent so many years in the yoke of oppressive mistresses. "I am your new commander. Who among you claimed to lead these women?" She swept a whipsaw gaze across them. "Who will be my underling here?" "We are not underlings," one sinewy honored Matres sneered, spoiling for a fight. "We don't know you, nor do we recognize your authority. You act like an honored Matres, but you have the smell of witches about you." "I don't think you are either." So Mirbella killed her. The honored Matres leader had persecuted sisters here for years. Her kicks and blows were swift, but insufficient in the face of Mirbella's combined training. With a broken neck, snapped ribs, and blood oozing from burst eardrums, the arrogant woman dropped dead to the black stones of the reef settlement. Mirbella never broke a sweat. She turned to the others. "Now, who speaks for you? Who will be my first underling?" One of the other honored Matres stepped forward. "I am Matres Skira. Ask your questions of me." "I will know about the Soustones and your operations here. We need to know how to extract profits from Boozle." "The Soustones are ours," Skira said. "This planet is..." Mirbella dealt her a blow across the chin so swiftly that it sent the woman reeling backward before she could raise a hand to defend herself. Looming over her like a bird of prey, Mirbella said, "I ask again. Explain the Soustone operations to me." One of the downtrodden Bene Gesserits broke from her line. A middle-aged woman with ash-blonde hair, she had a worn face that must once have been strikingly beautiful. "I can explain it to you." Skira scuttled like a crab onto her elbows, trying to get to her feet. "Don't listen to that cow. She's a prisoner, fit for beating and nothing else." "I am called Carista," the blonde said, ignoring Skira. Mirbella nodded. "I am Mother Commander of the New Sisterhood. Mother Superior Odraid herself chose me as her successor before she was killed in the Battle of Junction. I have unified Bene Gesserits and honored Matres to stand against our common, deadly enemy." She nudged Skira with her foot. Only a few renegade-honored Matre enclaves such as this remain. We will either assimilate them or grind them to dust. Honored Matres are not so easily defeated, Skira insisted. Mirbella looked down her nose at the woman on the ground.
You were?
She focused on Carista. You are a reverend mother.
I am.
But I was exiled here for the crime of love.
Love.
The wiry Skira spit the word out, as if expecting agreement from her conqueror. She began to talk about Carista in a derisive, hard-edged voice, calling her a baby stealer and a criminal to both the Bene Gesserits and the honored Matres. Mirbella gave the sister a quick, appraising glance.
Is that true?
Are you a notorious stealer of babies? Carista kept her eyes averted.
I could not steal what was already mine.
No, I was the victim of theft. I nurtured both children out of love when no one else would. Mirbella made up her mind on the spot, knowing she had to learn quickly.
In the interests of speed and efficiency, I will share with you.
That way, she could gather all the information from Carista in an instant. The other woman hesitated only for a moment, then bowed her head and leaned forward so that Mirbella could touch her, brow to brow, mind to mind. In a flood, the mother commander drew in everything she needed to know about Boozle, and far more than she had wanted to learn about Carista. All of the other woman's experiences, her daily life, her knowledge, her painful memories, and intense loyalties to the sisterhood became part of Mirbella.